Welcome to the Wellbeing Ignites Well-Doing podcast, produced by OOT Social Health, where the focus is on exploring the essential elements that drive organizational success, human-centric leadership. Hosted by Adjoa Boahidi, principal of AKB Talent Edge. Today's guest is Sophia Drolia, Director of Diversity, Inclusion, and Equity at a national payments company. She is passionate about building cultures that value diversity, champion inclusion, and promote collaboration to drive business results. She's committed to developing environments where differences are valued and where people are empowered to bring their authentic selves to the workplace. I learned quite a bit about Sophia in doing my research online, though I did assure her I didn't creep anything social media, just what was professionally available. She is a parent of two and is an open book. She's committed to demonstrating authenticity, which means being open, honest, and showing vulnerability, especially as a leader. Welcome, Sophia.
Thank you so much, Adjoa.
My pleasure.
Good to be here.
Oh, great. We're happy to have you. So, Sophia, I'm going to take us a tiny bit off the beaten path, because at the Council, we believe about being human-centric in the age of AI. And so you're human. Let's center on you. And the way I do that is I use the Proust questionnaire. Marcel Proust was an essayist and an author who would use these questions in sort of his parlor games, because he felt that in asking these questions and getting your responses, that we will come to know your true nature and who you are. So my first question for you, Sophia, is which talent would you most like to have?
Tiling.
Okay. Out of a billion things, I think I thought I might hear, that would definitely not even rank in the first 999 million.
Tiling is so beautiful and it's so like precise, and I'm just not good at that. Like carpentry. Like if I could build and make beautiful things, I would do that.
Amazing. So I have a kitchen backsplash. I'll text you offline. If you were to die and were to come back as a person or thing, what would it be?
A cardinal, a red bird. And mostly because they're just so beautiful. And especially in the winter when it's like just everything's dead. And then you just see you can still see the beauty. They're so strong and vivid. Mind you, it's the male that carries the beauty. But so, yeah, like a male red bird.
Amazing.
Or a straight white male. One or the other. I think I would then both. Either way.
Boy, I think we could just speak about a half an hour just on that. But, you know, we'll let that go for the moment and we'll continue on. Because today we really want to talk about using data and being data-centric and how that relates to well-being, to creating spaces and environments, workplaces where we promote well-being. And sometimes we would think being data-centric and human-centric might not actually be partners. So these terms don't always seem like they would be dance partners. Why are they, Sophia?
Why are they dance partners? Well, I don't think they can exist without each other, truthfully, because like it's one thing to know anecdotal stories from individual people. But once you start seeing it on a whole, you can really start identifying whether there are gaps that you need to address. And I find that, you know, once you have data, what gets measured gets done. And I think that's really the key, is when we can start seeing patterns, then you can actually put color to those stories. So, you know, I might get anecdotal stories from employees, but once I can see that through data, then I can take that to executives and I can say, hey, this is what's happening. And then there's just more power in being able to have collective human stories versus just the one-off. So I think those two, they can't exist without each other.
Excellent. And what kind of, you mentioned data and using data in order to help inform and whether it's to build business cases for executives or inform strategies, what kind of data can help organizations understand their current state within the DEI journey?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. So there's quite a bit. And the first and foremost for me is self-ID, and that's your demographics. But before even collecting that, the biggest thing you have to do is build trust. I think, you know, it's really important to build trust with your organization and through your leaders. And a lot of that for me is through leading with empathy and authenticity. So, you know, you build trust and then you launch with a simple self-ID campaign. And so first it's like, who are your people? And then it's a matter of who are your people? How are they feeling? And so it's measures of various engagement, inclusion drivers. Like you look at various drivers that are important to the organization. And so you have, now you have who your people are. Then you have, how are they feeling? And then the other piece is, how are they moving through the organization? Is there true equity built into how they're moving through the organization? So other data points I would look at are, you know, promotions, lateral movements, exits, and even performance reviews. So that's not individual performance reviews, but performance reviews in aggregate to see, are there discrepancies? Are certain leaders rating certain identities better than others? And are there gaps? And again, this isn't to remove the advantages that people have. It's really to remove the barriers that are in place. And you use data to identify those barriers and then remove those barriers and then start building in true equity into the organization.
Thank you. There are a couple points also from our prep interview that I'd like to highlight that you had mentioned, and I thought they were really important for our listeners to hear. And that was, as you're doing the self-ID and as you're collecting that data, you had mentioned to me that it's important to essentially ask that data only once.
Yes.
And so maybe expand a little bit on that. And then obviously the opportunity to update. So, but if you could just expand on how often, because it's true, employees must get tired. Every time I do an engagement survey, I'm being asked, you know, my characteristics, my qualifiers.
Yeah, and that's really annoying because the reality is our identities don't typically change. I mean, there might be certain aspects, like your gender identity may change along the way, and congratulations if it does. But the reality is, for most of us, our identities don't change over our work time. And so why do we have to ask people? Like, you know, you typically don't ask your, you know, if you're a people leader, you don't ask your team members what their names are over and over and over. So you wouldn't ask any other aspect of their identity. So why we do that in surveys repeatedly makes no sense. And usually it's because there's no proper system or strategy in place to actually house that data. And so my personal recommendation and the way that I find is super beneficial is actually housing that data within your organization. So that could be in your HRIS systems. And I think that's really key because that can inform all your other pieces. So when I even talk about connecting it to your workforce data, it becomes that much easier because I don't have to go out and ask for identity and then tie that back to employee profiles. This, in fact, is attached to your employee profile. So you enter your organization as part of your onboarding, you do your self-ID disclosure, and then it's just there. And the nice part about it is that you control that data as well. So if you're feeling like, I don't actually trust the organization with my data, well, guess what? You control it. You can remove it. Decide, you know what? I don't want them to have information about me, or I don't feel safe. Or actually, you know what? I think by them knowing that I'm a member of the 2SLGBTQ+ community, then that allows me to help inform and influence. And I think that's really important.
And so that comes also back to the word that you used at the outset of this question, again, is the word trust. Do you think, I mean, I guess it's a bit of a barometer, right, at the start, if you're launching a self-ID campaign, it's a bit of a barometer to be able to gauge how much employees currently trust your organization and then work on that to build it. And sorry. Excuse me for a moment. And do you also feel that, or that there's been an evolution? Maybe this question isn't fair, but do you feel as if employees are trusting these kinds of identification questions more in the sense that they feel that it's not going to be abused, or is that really dependent on the organization and its ability to have built trust?
I think it's the latter, to be honest. I think you really have to be truly authentic in how you're approaching this and what you're going to do with this data. And, you know, from day one, when I started at this current organization, I went around, I did roundtables, I talked to people, and I said, look, I can't do any of this work without the data. I had buy-in from all the top executives. They also, you know, we worked side by side. It was a big communications effort. It wasn't just, you know, myself in a bubble. And it was also for everyone else to understand what we're going to do with it. And then the key is, you launch it, you say what you're going to do with it, but you have to follow through. Because and the biggest part for me as well is do not collect any data if you're not going to do anything with it. So, for example, initially we thought, yeah, let's collect religion. And religion for me was also important to ensure that we are covering all the holidays. We know, like from an acknowledgement perspective, we know what holidays are happening. And then I looked at it and I realized, you know, we're not actually using the data I thought in the way that I thought we would. So then I'm like, we don't need this anymore. Let's remove it. So we got rid of it because it's just, you know, if you're going to ask the questions that you're going to use data from, and then make sure you follow through and share that data. What are you doing with it? And continue building on that to continue building trust, because the reality is you're not going to get 100% of participation. But you'll start somewhere and then you have to build on that. And the way to build on that is to continue proving that you are actually doing something meaningful with the data.
Amazing. Amazing. And I think I 100% concur, though, the follow up, the closing of the loop to demonstrate in what, and it doesn't have to be very big strategic changes initially. It can also be smaller tactics or smaller activities that you're doing, but showing that you're doing something with the data is critical, because otherwise people also become jaded as it relates to the efforts being made. And it can work in contrast to your attempted goal or your desired goal, which is greater engagement and well-being of your employees.
Absolutely.
And so we've talked about quantitative data, the need to gather it. And you had at the outset also talked about focus groups and qualitative data. But how do you use then that qualitative data to make decisions in your work?
Yeah, I mean, qualitative data is where I started my career. Actually, I started it in market research as a qualitative researcher. And so to me, I'm quite biased in the importance of qualitative data. It colors everything. It gives, to me, it gives meaning to your numbers. Numbers are just numbers. But it gives you, you know, numbers will give you some direction, some insight, you know, identify gaps, but without really getting to the meat of it. And that's by people telling you why they're rating certain things, or why they're not joining your organization, why they're leaving your organization. Like, why do we do exit interviews, right? That's all qualitative, but that's the meat as to what is happening. That's the real stories. And I think without, like, it's the same as to your first question, right? The human and the data, it's the same thing. It's the qualitative, the quantitative. They can't exist in silo. They work together to really create the powerful narrative of what's happening.
That's right. It's about story building, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So once upon a time, we sometimes only availed ourselves of the qualitative, right? Doing focus groups and then sometimes trying to code that a bit or find themes. So then we moved also into the quantitative, the hard, sort of the hard numbers. But the two together, as you have said, build that narrative.
It's so, heart and mind, right? Like you have to have the science. Like you have the science, but you also have to have the heart with it. Like you can't just go on with, because it's hard to make inferences just on numbers. You can. But it, without the feeling behind those numbers, I don't think it's as easy to make the change.
And I would suggest it's also harder to gain that commitment, even at the senior level, right? I shouldn't say even at the senior level, like they're heartless, but I would say, right? But for all of us and at the senior levels where you would think that they would just want data, 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 it is really the stories that move and that affect and have and bring to light the experiences that employees are having. And the senior leaders that I know are always committed to improving the workplace, to creating greater engagement, and to ensuring that everyone has their potential to be their, right, their best self, their authentic self. And so it's those stories that help change or move or motivate or massage that heart to
action. It connects all of us, right? It's truly what connects all of us. And even, you know, I have the privilege of opening all of our town halls and I do them all, you know, with our land acknowledgement, and I follow through with a story. And I always do that. And I do that, you know, the story is really, again, it's part of building that trust. And it's also to humanize what DEI is and why I do this work and what it means. And, you know, I'll share a certain story about inclusion or diversity or experiences that I'm pulling from my own life. But afterwards, people are like, oh, And, you know, and it really starts shifting their perspective on what DEI is, but it also allows them to connect with me that this is real work that happens and this is the experiences that happen behind it. So here's the data, but they all love the storytelling. And what's nice is I'm seeing the executives at our town hall, they're also starting to do some storytelling. So we're seeing the power of that, but because that's honestly, to me, that's the real basis of human connection.
Amazing. And I think storytelling, I mean, towards the end of this podcast, I'll be asking you concrete tips, but certainly telling stories is something that all leaders can do, all individuals can do, but the power of storytelling you've just highlighted for us. So I'd like to ask you about changes in talent management strategy or practices. What can happen as a result of understanding all of this data?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a few things. So one, it'll identify, you know, are you recruiting the best talent from all the talent pools, right? Because I think that's the biggest piece is typically we go to the standardized pools, right? Like you'll go to the LinkedIn of the world and you'll go there, but that doesn't mean you're all your best talent is on LinkedIn. They could be, you know, through other sources. And I think it's important we dive deep, right? There are other industry partners and organizations that you can partner with to really hone in on other top talent that may not necessarily know how to use LinkedIn or even care to use LinkedIn because they're not marketing themselves. They're just really good at their jobs and they don't care to necessarily market themselves. So I think, you know, one of the big pieces is when you identify the gaps of who's coming into your organization, I think the key is it's not that you're necessarily doing anything wrong. It's just that you're not looking everywhere you need to be looking and you're not partnering with all the organizations to help expand your talent pools. So I think all it does is it expands your talent pools to continue to get the best talent, but just from a wider talent pool.
That's great. And from a previous lifetime, I will give a plug to the newcomer talent pool that has oftentimes not well represented because to your point, they may not realize also the power of LinkedIn and how marketing yourself is such a American, North American characteristic. And so there's a ton of untapped talent in our newcomer talent pool among other equity denied groups for sure.
Yeah. And that whole like LinkedIn, I love it, but it's so narcissistic and not natural for so many of us, right? I'm on LinkedIn and I will post all the posts because this is what I've learned and I've been taught. But that isn't the natural psyche of a human to constantly market myself, you know, on social media to show you like, look at me. That's not normal. And that's what we've normalized in North America, right? And so while we have those that know how to play the game, that still doesn't mean that they're the top of the game. So I think that's the key is just knowing that there are folks outside of there that are the top and they are the best. We just need to reach those markets. And that's also about intentional effort and intentional work. And I think that's what happens when you have this data, then your talent strategy also becomes even more intentional.
Intentional and proactive, right?
Yep.
Those are the two sort of verbs that we or adjectives that we need to use is being intentional and being proactive. And so, Sophia, your job is not easy. I don't know if there are such things as easy jobs out there, perhaps, but yours is certainly not one of them in the sense that in the DEI journey, you're also going to have a lot of competing priorities. And especially for private sector corporations, right? It's about maximizing shareholder return. And so it may not always be the case that DEI is at the very top of the list of those priorities. And even within our DEI journey, you may have competing priorities. What should you focus on? Should it be performance management? Should it be recruitment? Should it be career advancement? And so it's impossible also to be everything to everyone. So that's the third impossibility. Boy, I'm sounding really positive today about your role. Who would like to be a director of DEI? Please sign up here. So it's impossible to be everything to everyone. How do you balance all of these things? In 5 short words. No, I'm kidding.
You know, I often ask myself the same thing. And I will say this role, not like the way this role is designed in society and the way it's been designed since, you know, post 2020, because I have the advantage of working in it pre 2020, is designed for one person to do it all. And it's not sustainable. It's high burnouts. I've seen people who are amazing at this work who have just been like, I, I just can't do it anymore because they're understaffed, under-resourced, and overworked. And so I think prioritization is actually so important to avoid burnout. And you do that, and you do that in first and foremost, realizing that this work takes time to make real change. It's not you're going to wake up and say, all right, this needs to happen. This is a certain gap in our data and we need to see a change right away. This is all about if we're thinking about long-term sustainable change, it's all about the small things we do on a quarterly basis. It doesn't need to all happen at once. But, you know, if you're a passionate leader in DEI, you want to do it all at once. Like you want to get it all out because you're constantly also trying. I find that I'm constantly also trying to prove the value of this role because people don't necessarily understand the role. So I'm always have to be on. I always have to, you know, show that I'm making change or that change is happening somewhere, or that it's impacting, it's influencing. So it's a lot. It's a lot of, truthfully, it's a lot of burden to carry. But, you know, from a prioritization perspective, it's not hard to support the organizational priorities. Because if DEI is done well, it truly should be embedded into an organization and it should be everyone's responsibility. It is not the sole responsibility of the single DEI leader. It is the responsibility of all leaders in this organization. And that's why you go back to data, because that data creates accountability. And when you have accountability, you have action. And so when you hold leaders accountable, they start embedding DEI into everything we do. And I think that's the way to effectively move DEI in an organization. But I think, you know, even within, there are so many areas of focus. And you think about all the employee resource groups and the competing priorities. And I think it's important to just tackle one thing at a time. You can't solve it all. You can't be it all for everyone. And I think it's just you take one thing at a time and you see who can help from, you know, employee resource groups, who wants to take certain things on, who can drive things forward. And then ensuring there's accountability through the organization, I think, is really important. And then, you know, you create goals, right? Like short-term goals, long-term goals. You work on it on a quarterly basis. And, you know, the top two or three things you're going to achieve and you stick to that. It's hard to say no, and myself included. I am terrible because I want to take it all on. I want to solve all the world's problems, but I have to, you know, I really have to just do well for these top three things and then figure out what the next top three things are and do it quarter by quarter. And then you see that change happen over time. I think that's, you know, for me, the most important.
So I think that was a terrific answer. I want to tease out of there something almost that you said that is a tension in here as well, is that to affect change and certainly at least transformative change, that is a long-term goal and that is a long-term strategy. And yet you mentioned several times this notion of quarter by quarter, right? And being measured almost on this quarterly basis and leaders expecting things to come so quickly. And so perhaps comment on that, because I have found that that's been one of the challenges for DEI leads and for those who are charged with creating this transformative change, but we'd like it happening by Q3 of next year. Is that okay? Can we make that right? And then there's frustration on senior leaders' part. Even if you said I've done, you can prove everything, because I'm sure you've documented it. There's this frustration in particular of late in the last couple of years. Well, why hasn't everything been solved yet? So, right? We gave you 3 quarters. So can maybe comment on that? How do you feel? How do you manage the expectations of employees? Because employees want to see rapid change as well as senior leaders, and you're that person in between. How do you manage that tension?
Yeah, I mean, the reality is you're looking at dismantling 400 years of history, right? 400 years of where identities have been left behind. And so you can't do that overnight. It's not even realistic to expect that. And I think it's going in full honesty with that. So what, you know, when I'm interviewing for any roles, I'm very clear I'm not coming in to create change overnight. I'm coming in to build out success to become a long-term strategy. So what I'm not doing is I'm not asking you to go out and find the one racialized leader to checkbox and be like, yes, we did it. We put a racialized person in a position of power. All right. My job is.
Or have a toucanism, right? We've got two of them now.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Like, it's not about tokenism. It's not about checkbox exercises like that. To me, that's what I think how DEI was defined of like, oh, okay, we got to go and find the next Black person to go and put them in places of leadership. And okay, we're done. But then you don't set them up for success. There's no coaching. There's nothing. And then in it, like they end up failing or leaving because they know they're not set up for success. And then they're like, oh, well, we tried it and didn't work. So we'll go back to our old ways. Rather than we look at it from a like systemic, right? It's a systemic problem that we're targeting. It's not people. It's the systems that are in place. And how do we dismantle? How do we break down those actual systems that are in place? And to me, that's really rooted again in if you can identify the gaps of where inequity exists. So as simple as performance reviews, right? Performance reviews happen on an annual basis. I can't say performance reviews is a perfect process. I'm not the performance review expert, so I'm not going to comment on that, but it's not a perfect process. But when you look at it in aggregate and you can see that certain identities are excelling over others, then there's an issue. And then if we keep seeing that, and that's going to be on an annual basis. So if you keep seeing that, or if you don't see change after the first review of that cycle, then there's a problem. But as soon as you see gaps, you tackle those gaps, right? You figure out what are the biases that exist in this process. And then it's not penalizing the manager who's had that performance review. It's looking at, okay, how do we support the folks that aren't getting those better performance reviews? What is stopping them from succeeding? And I think that's key. And that's how you start dismantling the barriers and providing real equity is providing the supports in place for those that aren't traditionally getting the supports. And they're not saying it because they don't even know sometimes they're not being set up for success. So I think to me, that's really key is really getting to those underlying systems at play versus the people. Reality is all of us are victims to the systems that we work in. It's not an us versus them. It's not a, you know, because you're a cisgendered white person, you're excelling because you're white. It's the reality is the systems are designed to allow you to excel and to hold me back. But that's not your fault. It's not my fault either. It's the fault of the systems in which we're born into. But it's like, how do we get to those deep? And so for me, one of the tangible things is like high school experiences. How do we get high school students? You know, we work closely with a local school board who focuses on Black students. And so then we, you know, have created experiential learning for those Black students to come to our workplaces. We do experiential learning and then we partner that with an internship in the summer. So now before they go to post-secondary, they're going in with experience in a corporate workplace. Then when they go for their first internships, they now have experience. So you can't use experience. You can't hold them. You know, you can't hold that against them. Oh, you don't have experience. They can't be judged against that anymore. And so it's like those are the types of systemic barriers I'm looking at of really breaking down.
Right. And that for sure all takes longer than a quarter. Right?
Yeah.
Especially, what I appreciate about your example is that reaching back also into the broader system in order to help. And I think also when we're looking to your point, it's not about the manager and it's not always about the employee because we're not just wanting to teach the employee how to fit into the system. We need to look at the system in and of itself. Yeah. Think about the design of that system and then maybe using principles like universal design to modify that system in order to create, right, that greater opportunity.
And it takes a full year to review again. Right. So even that, right, like because your performance reviews are happening once a year. So if you're only looking at that data point, that's a year. And so you're going to look at your first data point. That's your baseline. So that doesn't even necessarily mean you need to make change. It's just your baseline. Right. And then you're going to measure again and you're going to see what's changed throughout that. And then also, I mean, there has to be recommendations and how are you following those? And you can use as simple as representation, right? I can give you a makeup of, you know, what your function looks like. And then you can start making changes. But if those, like, you can't all of a sudden, and this goes back to, you can't all of a sudden go do checkbox exercises. You have to be intentional in those. And so you might not see change in your representation in the first year of your data, and that's okay. You shouldn't be penalized against that. What are you doing, A, to retain those staff? What are you doing to, like, are you in those communities? Are you building the brand? Are you showcasing that this is where you want to work? Because don't assume also that they want to work for you, right? And they, I mean, as, you know, equity deserving groups, they may not actually want to work for you. So it's also understanding that how are you showing up authentically in those communities? And then it's, so that takes time. Building relationships with the communities takes time. And then, yeah, maybe they'll come work for you, but it doesn't happen as just a checkbox, go and find, you know, a racialized woman to come and work on my team. It doesn't work as simply as that. And if it does, then that's a problem.
Right. That might be a bit of a red flag, right?
Yeah.
And so before I bring us to the last question, I actually forgot what I was going to ask you. I was going to follow up with another very brilliant point, Sophia. That's okay. Now it has escaped me. So we're going to move on to the last question that we ask all of our guests. And it's really very tactical. We want to understand from you, and our leaders who are listening today want to understand from you, what is one thing, what is one or two things that I am going to do today? Because I'm actually on the 401 stuck in traffic. Oh, I'm being very Toronto-centric. I'm on a highway, stuck in traffic. And right, I'm driving to work and I'm listening to this fabulous podcast with Sophia. And she's now going to tell me when I get into the office, here are the one or two things that I'm going to do to be inclusive so that my team members' well-being is being supported.
I think, you know, the first and foremost is lead with empathy. I think that is key. And I think, you know, And going deeper into that, I think it's really important, like, listen to your people, pay attention to their body language, pay attention to what they need, what's working for them, what's not working for them. I think that's really key, because when you are an empathetic leader, you will get the best out of your people because you're creating psychological safety. And when someone feels safe and someone feels like they belong, they will give you 125% and you will be. You know, because just when you walk a neighborhood, if, you know, I was in Dubai recently and I identify as non-binary. I was scared because of all these perceptions, but I've never felt so safe in my entire life. I didn't have to hold keys in my hands at midnight to, you know, feel like, oh my gosh, I have to protect myself. I've never felt. And then it's like my body was so relaxed. I got to actually enjoy the city. I got to explore. And so when you think about that in the workplace, if I'm constantly like stressed and I can't, you know, be myself, I can't authentically speak up or voice some concerns that may be different from the larger group, then I'm not operating at my best. And if I'm not operating at my best, I'm not giving my best, and then you're not getting the best out of me. And so we're both doing each other a disservice. So I think leading with empathy to me is the most critical piece I would leave with anybody, is because that will allow productivity and gains to come.
And what I really appreciated what you said about part of leading with empathy is body language. I think we underestimate how much we can learn, even via video, right?
Yeah.
Certainly in face-to-face, from body language. You know, somebody sitting like this versus open at their desk, or they're leaning away, right? And so there's lots of things we can just quickly Google about what's being open and receptive versus closed. And at team meetings, as leaders, just having a sense of that can take you a long way to then understanding and asking those questions to build that empathy, or demonstrate, not build it, but demonstrate that empathy.
Yeah. And there are plenty of courses, because empathy doesn't come naturally. And I people shouldn't, you know, feel like, oh, I'm not empathetic. It's a skill. You can learn it. So, I mean, instead of saying I'm not empathetic, figure out how to become empathetic. Like, it's not something that you're, it's not the cilantro enzyme. You love it or hate it.
I love it, right? Empathy, I think that should just be the tagline for this podcast. Empathy is not cilantro. It's not like cilantro. So, Sophia, we're nearing to the end of the podcast, but I always like to end wonderful conversations with getting to know you just a little bit further than we have so far. So I have a couple more questions about you. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be, Sophia?
It's hard because what I love about myself, sometimes I also want to change about myself, and it's sometimes I care too much and too deeply. And so, and it affects me so deeply. And I think, you know, I wish I could care less, but then I don't want to care less. You know what I mean? Like it's a,
sure.
It's, and so I think, yeah, if I could change, no, but this is a tough, to be honest, that's tough because that's my worst and my best.
It's a mixed blessing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So I guess it's, you know what it would be is to change how I react to how, like my deep feelings. I think that's what it is. Like to have more control over my reactions to my deep feelings. That's what I would change.
Thank you. And last but not least, who are your heroes in life?
I would say I have two. My wife, she inspires me honestly daily to be a better person. She like all the time, she will put me in my spot. Just because I'm a DEI leader does not mean I don't mess up and I don't have biases. And she really inspires me to be a better parent and just to be a better human overall. And my mom, and I would never have said that growing up. Because we were always opposing, you know, immigrant parent, person born here, like very different perspectives, you know, very religious, not very religious, like constant battles in our household. But, you know, she did the best she could with everything she had in coming to a new country. And she came here with $7 and everything that she's given me. I aspire to be half the parent she was. And I would never have said that before. Because I didn't realize, I didn't appreciate, you know, the boundaries she set. She was hard. She was a hard parent, but it really made me a better person for it.
She did a great job, Sophia.
Thank you.
You tell her that I said she did. A complete random stranger on a podcast said she did a great job. Thank you so much, Sophia. We are honored to have had you with us today. And on behalf of the Employee Wellbeing Council, we thank you and we wish you a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Wellbeing Ignites Well-Doing podcast, brought to you by OOT Social Health. We hope today's conversation has sparked new insights and inspired you to prioritize well-being in your journey to organizational success. Remember, when well-being ignites, well-doing follows. Stay tuned for more episodes as we continue to explore the power of human-centric leadership. Until then, be well and lead with purpose.